I'm traveling the country talking about my autobiography, and afterwards maybe we could have some questions or comments, and I'd be happy to sign copies. But if you know, if I just don't say anything, all I want to say is thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for all you do for peace and justice, for all you do to make the world a better place, for all you do for the Church of Peace and Justice and the God of Peace and Justice. And I just want to encourage you to keep walking the road to peace and doing whatever you can. It's so important. And my disclaimer is, please call me John, because my name is so goofy, Father Dear doesn't work. So don't call me, just call me John. Can I borrow this chair for a second? And these microphones, I got microphones all over me. I'm reminded of the young priest, maybe you heard the story. He was given his first homily and he's very nervous, and he comes up and he taps on the microphone. He says, "Something's wrong with this microphone." And the congregation goes, "And also with you." I hope that's not, I'm trying to cheer you up here on a cold Wednesday night, and just, I don't think it's working. You all don't have Jesuits here in Johnson City, do you? You're lucky. No. I don't know if Pat said that, but brace yourselves, I'm a Jesuit. And no, don't be silly. So there was a Franciscan and Dominican and a Jesuit. This is my best joke here, so hang on. And I'm trying to tell you what you're in for. And they're on a weekend retreat, and they're not. The retreat master says, "I want you to pray over your funeral. There you are, laid out in an open casket. There's 1,000 people. What do you want them all saying about you? Go off and pray about that and come back." So they go off and pray about it and come back. The Franciscan says, "I want him to say he was just like St. Francis. He loved the poor and worked for peace." And the Dominican says, "I want him to say he was just like St. Dominic. He loved the word of God and he was a fiery preacher." And the Jesuit says, "I want him to say, hey, I think he's moving." That's not very good, but it's the best I got. I don't know. I'm just trying to make you laugh a little bit. Things are rough out there. Well, dear friends, maybe you're feeling a little hope in the air these days. I hope, yeah. But my prayer and life and message with you is that I want to invite us to go all the way to the frontiers of biblical hope, into the audacity of peace, if I can paraphrase somebody, to the audacity of gospel nonviolence, the audacity of following the nonviolent Jesus all the way on the road to peace, into God's reign of peace, which means, you know, given the election last week, our work is not over. That for the rest of our lives, we're walking the road to peace and working for peace and justice. What do you think of that? Amen. That's what we have to keep going no matter what. And in a nutshell, I'm not that bright. I'm a very simple view of life. As far as I've gotten, life is the journey to peace. The spiritual life, if you will, for those of us who are Christians, is living in the peace of Christ and following the nonviolent Jesus, which means to me, living at peace, making peace with yourself, living and breathing in peace, then making peace with everyone in your family, your spouses, your parents, your children, all your neighbors, making peace with everyone in Johnson City and Binghamton and everyone in New York, making peace with everyone in the church. Going to be really rough. I was hoping you'd laugh at that. Making peace with everyone in the world and seeing life as a journey, walking every day, no matter where you are, for the rest of your life, living and breathing in peace, walking one step at a time on the road to peace, toward a new future of peace, toward the God of peace. Isn't that a beautiful way to look at life? The problem is we're not walking the road to peace. We're barreling down the highway to war. There's over 30 wars happening tonight, not just the war in Iraq. And the United Nations says 900 million people are starving tonight. Some 35,000 children under five die of starvation every single day. And there's every form of violence, which we're seeing here in New York. You can name any kind of violence you want. Torture and racism and sexism and executions. But there's some 20,000 nuclear weapons. And in New Mexico, where I live, the government, the United States government, is building a whole new generation of nuclear weapons at Los Alamos. Did you know that? And I haven't even mentioned global warming. You know, that we're just rushing toward the destruction of the Earth. We're not talking about the journey of peace. We're talking about war on the poor, war on children, war on the human race, war on creation itself, and the God of peace. So if you're going to see with me, life is a journey in peace. From this day forward, the rest of your lives, you're going to be at peace with everyone and all creation. You have to also stand up and say no to war and the culture of violence and death as a social methodology. Death as a way of life. We kill people, you know, and we're going to say no to that. And I like this clumsy word that Gandhi uses from Ahimsa, nonviolence. And the night before our great hero, Martin Luther King Jr., was killed by our government in Memphis, 1968, 40 years ago. Remember when he gave the famous speech, "I've been to the mountaintop and all." He said, the choice is no longer violence or nonviolence. That's not what we're talking about. It's nonviolence or nonexistence. Unless we all become people of nonviolence, the Holy Prophet said, we're doomed toward our own self-destructive violence. So friends, I invite us, and what I'm talking about with my life, and invite you to go deeper, is to see ourselves as being, you know, heroes and champions and practitioners of this gospel nonviolence, as King is calling us to, that we're going to really work at being nonviolent toward ourselves. And if you will, plumbing even the mystical depths of inner nonviolence. How about that? That means, you know, looking non-judgmentally, deeply, just saying, noticing our violence, looking at the violence within and saying, okay, why did I do that? How can I become more nonviolent? And then being nonviolent toward everybody in our families, everybody in Binghamton, Johnson City, and then being part of the global grassroots movements of nonviolence to change the world. Gandhi and King say nonviolence is the only thing that works. You know, war doesn't work. War is obsolete now. The days of war are over. War only sows the seeds for future wars. And not only that, war is never blessed by God. War is not the will of God. We have to non-cooperate with violence and war and practice this methodology of nonviolence and work for a new world of nonviolence. Well, I love the abolitionists. And I think the abolitionists are part of your heritage here, you know, in New York and Rochester and all especially, maybe even in Johnson City and Binghamton. I don't know if you've ever studied them, but these people were crazy. Imagine them 200 years ago. They stand up and they say, excuse me, United States, we are announcing the abolition of slavery. And everybody said, what are you, crazy? There's always been slavery. There's always been slavery. Some people aren't people. It's even in the Bible. And they said, no. A new world is coming. A new world of equality, where every human being on the planet will be recognized as a sister and brother in one another. Friends, I invite us in this historical moment that we're in, as the world is rushing toward non-existence and our economies are collapsing in with these wars and poverty, as we're going to be part of the global grassroots movement of nonviolence, to identify ourselves as their ancestors and to see ourselves as new abolitionists and to stand up here in New York in this very important place where you are and announce like this, excuse me, United States, we are announcing the abolition of war itself and poverty and starvation and nuclear weapons and global warming. I don't know about you, but I say this all over the country and everybody says to me, well, you're just plain nuts. That's just ridiculous. That's it. And we're going to say, no, that's our future. We are announcing the coming of a new world of nonviolence. like the abolitionists, we're going to lift up that vision and give our lives toward it. It's the reign of God at hand. What do you think of that? Yeah, that's what we're going to be about. We have to somehow pursue that vision. Well, I'm 49 years old, and my parents and my three brothers are utterly appalled that I've written my autobiography. But I was just telling Pat that this is, it's like a 500-page book. It's half of what I wrote. I wrote 1,000 pages. They cut my childhood. But, I'm a Jesuit, and we're a little over the top, as you see. And, I really recommend this for all of you to do what I've done over these many years working on this book, to reflect on your life in this framework that I've just spoken about. How has your life, when you pray or you're driving along or you're meditating or talking with your spouse, think about this. How has your life from your childhood and your youth up till tonight been a journey on the road to peace? It's a very powerful way to look at life. How have you moved from violence to nonviolence? And you think about your youth and maybe the violence in your family or your childhood or being part of the culture of war, the culture of violence around us, and how you've begun to walk, to see life as the journey on the road to peace. And maybe more importantly, how are you going to, from tonight, this night, for the rest of your life, till your last day on earth, going to see your life consciously, mindfully, deliberately, as a journey on the road to peace, going deeper into mystical nonviolence and radical revolutionary nonviolence, into the God of peace? Well, that's a great way to look at the journey of life at this in this moment of history that we get privileged to live in. And that's what I wrote about in my book and why I'm talking about it. In a nutshell, maybe some of you know my sad story. I grew up Catholic, and I presume some of you are Catholic here, maybe parishioners at St. James. And I went to a Jesuit high school in Washington, D.C., and was so appalled, decided to leave the church and went to a good Methodist school to get away from us crazy Catholics, and Duke University in North Carolina. Then I thought, if you're going to leave the church, why not go all out and not believe in God? I mean, really. So I thought, that's a good idea. So I'm in this wild, crazy fraternity, and it's the late 1970s. And what happened to me was my junior year. See you later. There goes the news reporter. It's a good thing she's not going to hear all this. I was at Duke, and I'm deciding I don't believe in God. And it was like junior year, my first week, 1978, I think. And I was looking for an easy A. And I heard that if you take this certain psychology class, the professor asked you to do volunteer work once a week for him, you automatically got an A. I thought, that sounds good. I'll sign me up for that. So it was my first week, September, 1978. I'm a dopey 19-year-old kid, and I'm driven with a couple of students way out into the boondocks of North Carolina to the North Carolina State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. 7 miles of hallways with prison bars. It's 9 a.m, and these guards with machine guns split us up, and they take us down this hallway that goes on forever through these prison bars, and we come upon this room, me and the guard, this big room. I remember there were about 50 white cots with 50 men sitting on the edge of each cot, dressed in white with their heads shaved, and they had just stopped doing frontal lobotomies then, so you can imagine. And they're locked up for the rest of their lives. They have no visitors, the poorest of the poor. And the armed guard thinks I'm a psychiatrist from Duke. And he says to me, right, doctor, we'll be back for you at 5:00. And locks me in and leaves. And I was like, get me out of here. I was just looking for an easy A. And one of them started to talk with me, one of the men. And I started to talk back, and then another, and the whole day flew by, and I was overwhelmed by their suffering and their humanity, which is the gospel lesson about how the poor break our hearts and teach us what it means to be human. And I was very confused by this. And I went home that night, and as I say, is the beginning of my book, The fraternity party was in full swing. It was like going from, what, the least of the worst of our culture to the best and the brightest. And I tell you this because I decided I don't believe in God. And I got thinking, if there's no God, who cares about such poor people? In fact, if there's no God, there's no meaning to life. There's no purpose to reality. There's no moral vision or direction for the whole universe. We're all just going to die, and that'll be the end of it. So why not make as much money as you want? And who the hell cares about poor, suffering people around the world? And why not bomb and kill whoever you want? And I thought, well, okay, and I'm going to choose to believe that. But I kept going back each week, and I was so touched and moved by these suffering people. Anyway, make a long story short, after 6 months, one day I came to my senses and I said, oh, of course I believe in God, you dope. Oh, of course there's a loving God, and the whole human race is headed toward this loving God. Well, that means when we die, we're going to be met by this wonderful God who's going to go, oh, I'm so happy to see you. I love you so much. What did you do to help my suffering people? And then I got thinking, well, this is all or nothing. We have to give our whole lives, the short time we have on earth, to relieving the suffering of humanity and loving everybody and participating in God's project of love. And I thought, I have to give my whole life to God. And my next thought was, oh my God, I'm going to have to become a Jesuit. It was a major setback. I was a dopey kid, I told you. What did I know? So I go to see my parents. Mom, Dad, I'm going to become a Jesuit. And they were like, where did we go wrong? They were so upset. They begged me not to. So I agreed, okay, I'll wait for a while. And then I thought about St. Francis and St. Dominic and St. Ignatius. And if you read the fine print about the great saints, they all began their public careers before they did that. They all went to the Holy Land to see where Jesus lived. And I thought, that's a good idea to kind of get the lay of the land, so to speak. So I go back to my parents. Mom, Dad, I'm going to Israel for 3 months on holy pilgrimage to see where Jesus lived. And they were like, it's worse than we thought. And maybe some of you know what happened to me, or you've read the book. And I didn't know about this until I researched it for the book. This is May 1982. Israel invaded Lebanon. All the pilgrimages were canceled. Most of the people on the flight canceled. And it turns out it was all orchestrated in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon. And they actually named it in Washington, D.C., Operation Peace for Galilee. And we killed 60,000 civilians in those 3 months. So I went over, oblivious to all of this, a very naive, dopey 21-year-old kid, doing my little pious pilgrimage in Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Nazareth. And I was camping out at the Sea of Galilee, and it was for weeks, and it was just spectacular. Just not aware of what was going on. And I don't know if I should tell this story, or maybe I don't want to bore you all, but if you've heard this again, forgive me for repeating it, but it was a Wednesday afternoon, and it was the end of my time there, and my goal was really, literally, to be in the land of Galilee, which is, it's a lot different now. They put up McDonald's, but then it was just green hills. And on the north side of the Sea of Galilee is a little hill with a chapel, smaller than this room, and there were nobody around for miles and miles. And I finally arrive in this chapel, and I walk in, and there it says, in big letters on the wall of the church, like graffiti, if you can believe it, it's actually read on the church wall, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." And I thought, what the heck is that about? And I look around, and on the walls, there's 8 sides, and it says, "Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek, the gentle, the nonviolent. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure of heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those persecuted for working for justice." And then I notice on the altar it says, "Love your enemies." The Chapel of the Beatitudes, commemorating the Sermon on the Mount. And I practically said out loud, alone in the chapel, oh my God, I think he's serious. This had never occurred to me before. You know, I thought this stuff is like pious stuff you read like Shakespeare every 10 years on a rainy day. I'm suddenly thinking, this is the job description of the Christian. You know, my plan was to be a pious Jesuit, which I always joke is, and you probably think, an oxymoron. And I walk out on the balcony, and I'm standing out looking over the whole Sea of Galilee, and I'm looking up at the sky, and I'm talking to God, and I'm saying, is this what I have to do? You want me to hunger and thirst for justice? I have to be a peacemaker? I have to love my enemies and be persecuted for it? And that this is what it means to be Christian? We all have to do this? And I thought. I was overwhelmed by this. Sudden realization. I thought, okay, I'll give my life to the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount with all of you and work for peace and justice like all of you, on one condition. If you give me a sign. And I put my fist down on the balcony and I thought, well, there, I got God now, because those days of signs are over with. And, you know, that was a sure sign I was called to be a Jesuit, because I was looking for a loophole, you know. And all of a sudden there were these loud explosions and three Israeli jets fell from the sky, breaking the sound barrier, setting off these sonic booms, which was happening all the time. And they swooped right down on the Sea of Galilee, coming right at me. And they flew over my head and I ducked. And I looked up and I said, okay, I'll work for peace and justice and I'll never ask for a sign again. And of course, they dropped a whole bunch of bombs and killed a lot of people. And I've reflected on that experience ever since, because it changed my life. For a split second, I opened my eyes just in case, like God appeared. And what did I see? The reality of the world, which is mass murder. Sisters and brothers killing sisters and brothers. All over the planet tonight. Actually, in the name of God.
Actually, in the name of Jesus. Actually, at the place where Jesus said, love your enemies. It was incredible. And I entered the Jesuits realizing that we're all called to be Sermon on the Mount people, to enact the Beatitudes and these teachings as how to be human in a world, an inhuman world, how to be nonviolent in a world of total violence. And so, you know, like so many of you, was involved in working to stop the wars in Central America and our nuclear weapons. And I befriended Daniel and Philip Berrigan, our great heroes. And that led me organizing demonstrations and then getting arrested in protests and then getting arrested.
Now I've been arrested like 75 times and I have a long criminal record. I have a problem with recidivism, but that's another issue. And went to El Salvador, which I tell in detail. To work under the direction of the Jesuits from the university, and they sent me out to a refugee camp. All the people, in 1985, they'd lost all their loved ones in the horrible war there, and the U.S. was bombing the countryside. And the idea was when the death squads came in, they'd send us the white gringo Jesuits out there, hoping that they'd kill us first, or thinking maybe they wouldn't open fire if we were there. And talk about working through your nonviolence quickly. You know, here comes it was a kid with the machine gun. And I'm like, hi, how you doing? I'm John, can I help you? You need anything? He's got a machine gun. And you know what happened to the Jesuits? It'll be 19 years on Sunday. They were assassinated, six of them, my friends, by 28 soldiers, 19 of them trained in Fort Benning in Georgia at the School of the Americas. And next week, about 25,000 of us are going to gather there to call again for the closing of the School of the Assassins. And we hope that's going to happen. Because the killings continue. I just spent nearly a month in Colombia not a while back. And Colombia, 200,000 people have been killed there in the last 20 years. All of it directed by the United States. Well, in 1993, I went with Philip Berrigan and a couple other friends into North Carolina, into the biggest Air Force base in the country, where they have the F-15E. We walked right through it in the 4 a.m. through thousands of soldiers, right? It was like three JFK airports. Came up to one of the big fighter bombers, and we each took out a hammer, and I went up to the side of it, and I hammered on the side of the big fighter bomber. You know, it was like the cartoons. I swung back, didn't chip the paint or make a dent. And for that action, I faced 20 years in prison and was convicted of two felony charges. And now my judges tell me I'm as high up a terrorist as you can get in the United States, and I can never vote again. I can't travel to a lot of countries. I'm totally regularly monitored by the government for the rest of my life. But I just said, in the Bible, it says someday these people are going to come along and beat their swords into plowshares and study war no more. And Jesus gave this famous commandment. It says, love your enemies, don't nuke them. That's the actual Greek translation. That's what I told the judge, but that didn't go over too well. I ended up doing 9 months in a tiny jail cell, which was horrific and yet incredibly powerful spiritual experience. And then the judge sentenced me to 10 more months under house arrest at the Jesuit community in Washington, D.C., which I wrote in the book was cruel and inhuman punishment. But don't tell the Jesuits, I said. And, you know, like you, my journey just takes me so many places. I work with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I led a delegation of Nobel Prize winners to Iraq. I had just stepped down when September 11th had happened. I went down that morning to volunteer, and the head of the Red Cross asked me to coordinate the chaplains working at the Family Center. And I worked at Ground Zero, and we had 550 chaplains ministering to 50,000 direct relatives. And while I was doing that in the evenings, I was organizing with friends the demonstrations to stop the evil bombing of children in Afghanistan. And the New York Times wrote about me doing both of those things. And the Jesuits started getting so many complaints. I got called in one day and was yelled at. And the superior said, we're kicking you out of New York. We don't want you here anymore for what you're doing. They said, I wrote about that in the book. I tell it all honestly. That's the only story that I remained in the book. The Jesuits removed a lot. They tried to kick me out about 25 times just for speaking out against war. But, you know, we're the same as the church and all of us complicit in the culture of war. They said to me, you can go anywhere in the country, and if you're not out of here in 3 months, we're sending you to teach sophomore religion in Philadelphia. That sounded pretty grim. I don't. No disrespect to you holy high school teachers. I thought nuclear disarmament would be easier than teaching sophomore religion, but that's just... So I moved to New Mexico, where I'm coming from now. Do you know it's the poorest state in the country, number one in nuclear weapons, number one in military spending, worst education system, number one in drunk driving, domestic violence, suicide. If you've been there, it's this spectacular, beautiful landscape. The Native American, Hispanic Catholicism, it's so beautiful. And yet at Los Alamos, the birthplace of the bomb, where there are more millionaires per capita than any other place on the planet, we're building a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. And all kinds of post-nuclear laser beam warfare. And it's a radioactive waste dump. So we started a church campaign with Pax Christi to close Los Alamos. This hasn't gone over well, but you do what you can. And I've been speaking out against the war, and I'm in a lot of trouble because, you know, it's a very predominantly Catholic state and very poor, and the Catholics are the ones making the bombs. And so, and the Archbishop gets all his money from the good Catholics at Los Alamos. So he's trying to have me kicked out of New Mexico at the moment, but I'm a very harmless guy, as you see, so we'll see what happens there. But I was reflecting, and maybe you can reflect too when you think about your life, and I've had all these adventures. Was there some turning point in your own life journey on the road to peace? Some moment that you really realized you want to go deeper and become a really nonviolent person and be part of the global grassroots movement to become a person of nonviolence. And that's what I was thinking as I was writing this. But then I came to my senses one day and I thought, no, the journey's the thing. The thing is to be faithful to the road to peace for the rest of our lives. And what I've grown to like so much now about Mahatma Gandhi and Dorothy Day and Dr. King, imagine the Berrigans and Merton and all these great heroes, is that they were faithful to the journey, to their last day, despite all the evidence. They kept following that nonviolent Jesus all the way. Dan is 87 now. Maybe you all know Daniel Berrigan, and he's very frail, but he's carrying on. He's just published the spectacular commentary from the perspective of nonviolence on the Book of Kings. Who reads the Book of Kings? It's brilliant. And he was, my other good friend is Steve Kelly. He's a Jesuit. He's about 59. And Steve has spent 6 years of his life in prison, most of it in solitary confinement for nuclear disarmament. You don't even know about him. And he's this holy, great guy. And they were having dinner about a year ago. And, you know, they were talking about Bush and the war. And Dan said to Steve, well, you know, as Jesus said, and Steve interrupted him and said, oh, you name dropper, you. So this is my advice to you, and this is what I've been doing now. I drop Jesus's name at the drop of a hat. In all these conversations when people are mad about, oh, abortion or the bishops or the church or the war or Bush or the Pope, somebody, we're mad at somebody and somebody's mad at you because you work for peace, just bring up the name of Jesus. Well, what do you think Jesus would say? And everybody says to me, well, why do you bring him up? What has he got to do with this? I'm like, oh, I'm saying, you know, what would he do? Mahatma Gandhi says Jesus is the most active person of nonviolence in the history of the world. Isn't that a great definition or description of Jesus from the great Hindu? And then Gandhi goes on to say, and the only people on the whole planet who don't know that Jesus was nonviolent are Christians. I'm with this late theologian, John Mackenzie, who said, it's the only thing you can say for sure about Jesus. Now, ponder that. The only thing you can say for sure about him is that he was nonviolent. Wow. I think all his teachings are spectacular nonviolence. Gandhi read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, every morning at 4 a.m., and at 5 p.m., and he did 2 one-hour prayer periods a day from 1903 to 1948. Twice a day he's reading from the Sermon on the Mount. And he's not even a Christian. Some of you Christians here, and do you read from the Sermon on the Mount twice a day? Isn't that a spectacular? He's saying, these are the greatest teachings of nonviolence in the history of the world. I want to be a person of nonviolence, so I have to read. This is the catechism. This is the how-to manual. And Jesus is practicing this creative nonviolence, and then he turns, like Gandhi on the Salt March, or Dr. King marching into Birmingham. Jesus marches into Jerusalem, confronts the religious authorities working with the empire to oppress all the poor people, and he turns over the tables of the money changers in an act of peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. But he's just saying, I am not going to tolerate injustice at all. I'm not putting up with any injustice. We are people of contemplative peace, Jesus says. If Jesus was upset about that, what would he say about, let's say, bombing and killing 1.2 million Iraqi civilians since March 2003? What would he say about Los Alamos, where we're planning the destruction of the planet, or the Pentagon, where we're involved in every war, often selling weapons to both sides in every war? He's public, active, daring, troublemaking, revolutionary, and illegal. You know, he doesn't hurt anybody. He doesn't hit anybody. He doesn't drop any bombs. But wow, is Jesus dangerous. I think like everything Jesus did was illegal, and then he was like a one-man crime wave. I thought you'd laugh at that. I'm trying to make you laugh in the midst of all this, but I know it's heavy. I'm coming to my end soon here, but when I talk about Jesus around the country, and this is the reason for what I do, why I work for peace and justice, because I'm trying to follow him. I want to make a better world, but as a Catholic, as a Christian, as a member of the Society of Jesus, I see him as the spectacular nonviolence, and I'm supposed to follow him. Well, when I go around the country, I just heard this in Ventura, California, 2 weeks ago. People say to me, well, gosh, John, this stuff is pretty interesting. That nonviolent stuff, that's quite intriguing. And personally, peace, I'm all for peace. Me, I'm a big fan of peace. But sometimes you just gotta kill somebody. The church was right to throw away the Sermon on the Mount in the year 300 when Constantine became the emperor and became Christian and then said, okay, you can all kill for me now and turn to the pagan Cicero to come up with moral justification for mass murder. And St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas then created the just war theory. And for 1700 years, we've been bombing and killing people for Jesus, even having holy wars, crusades, and now the priest blesses the bombs at Los Alamos. Or we're all Christians involved in killing, you know. And, you know, maybe you think that. Or maybe you think, you know, your family members or your neighbors here think that. If so, if you can hang in here with me for a second, go to that moment after Jesus gave his life doing that civil disobedience in the temple. You know, if you're on the outskirts of a horrible empire and you do civil disobedience, turning over the tables, you're going to be arrested and tortured and killed. That's a no-brainer, you know. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane. Here come the horrible Roman soldiers to arrest him and kill him. What does St. Peter do? Right. St. Peter is thinking, what's he thinking? He's thinking, well, he's the first hierarch. He's saying, my job is to protect my guy. I'm in charge. Jesus, I'm in charge. I'm going to protect you. And, okay, you could say he's right. And he's thinking, if ever in all of human history there was a moment when violence was divinely sanctioned, when there was a just war, when we should kill to protect the Holy One, it was at that moment. And as just as he goes to kill to do the right thing, the commandment comes down, put down the sword. Friends, I invite you to hear those words as the last words of Jesus to the church before he was killed. It was the last time he had the gang with him. And it was the first time they understood who he was. Peter's going, oh, he's so serious about this crazy nonviolence and agape and love your enemies and being like God. He's not even going to defend himself violently, which means we don't get to defend ourselves violently. And they get it and they run away from him. They have nothing to do with him because of nonviolence. And there's Jesus, unarmed, arrested, tried, tortured, executed, a victim of capital punishment, capital crime, killed with violent terrorists who were killing Roman soldiers. And read Gandhi on the crucifixion of Jesus. Gandhi says Jesus goes even deeper into nonviolence. It's the most perfect act of nonviolence in history. And this is the guy some of us claim to follow. You know, he forgives even his murderers. So you know what the recent non-canonical texts are saying, you know, we've been learning in the Greek, the scholars are saying, he rose from the dead and he appeared to Peter and he said to Peter, avenge my death. And Peter went and assassinated Pilate. And then the disciples formed these terrorist cell groups that spread all over Europe and they started killing all the Roman soldiers for revenge. No. That's not what happened. That's what should have happened if he was a good American like us. We should, like, if he was normal, we should have got some punishment going. He should have blown up at Peter, gotten some vengeance, a little retaliation maybe, or at least he should have been mad and held a grudge and been resentful. I mean, we get resentful at the smallest things. Jesus comes back. He makes breakfast for these guys. And he says to us, peace be with you. Peace be with you. Peace be with you. Now you walk the road to peace. You practice daring, creative nonviolence. You announce the abolition of war and poverty and nuclear weapons and global warming and give your life for the coming of God's reign at hand. And thank you so much for doing that with your lives. And I just want to encourage you to keep walking the road to peace and not be discouraged. God bless you. Thanks for listening.